From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, we remember composer Henry Mancini with a 1987 interview. Mancini died Tuesday of cancer at the age of 70. He composed hundreds of movie and TV themes, including The Pink Panther, The Days of Wine and Roses, Breakfast at Tiffany's, and Peter Gunn. Also from our archives, an interview with Dennis Hopper. He's now starring in two movies, the low-budget film noir Red Rock West and the hit thriller Speed. He made his film debut in Rebel Without a Cause in 1955. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Wolf, starring Jack Nicholson and Michelle Pfeiffer. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The Los Angeles District Attorney has filed murder charges against former football star O.J. Simpson. He used to be arraigned today in the slayings of his ex-wife, Nicole Brown Simpson, and Ronald Goldman, a friend of hers. NPR's Renee Montaigne says Simpson has also been charged with special circumstances. This could carry the death penalty.
What special circumstances means generally is that it adds a level of brutality or viciousness to the crime. It also adds a higher level of punishment. And in this particular double murder, there were two things that have been told to us by unnamed police sources, and that is that Nicole Simpson had her throat slashed. There are also reports that her friend had his throat slashed, but certainly he was stabbed a number of times and put up quite a struggle. That alone could ratchet up a charge to special circumstances.
NPR's Renee Montaigne. There's confusion over the status of possible U.S. sanctions against North Korea. The White House has disavowed former President Jimmy Carter's statement the U.S. will stop pursuing sanctions against the North over its nuclear program. President Clinton is reportedly waiting to get more information on the latest Korean offer to reopen high-level talks. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
The Clinton administration is still trying to confirm that the North Koreans are serious about making concessions in order to resume negotiations with the United States. Today, CNN reported from Pyongyang that former President Jimmy Carter, in North Korea for talks with President Kim Il-sung, said that the administration was holding off its pursuit of United Nations sanctions. Yesterday, President Clinton said he would continue pushing for sanctions. And today, when asked about Carter's reported comments, Mr. Clinton told reporters, "I don't know what he said, and I don't know if you know what he said either." Today, Vice President Gore was also asked about suspending the push for sanctions. He said it depends totally on what the circumstances are. The United States wants North Korea to stop reprocessing nuclear fuel, stop refueling its nuclear reactors, and keep all the United Nations inspectors in place. At the White House, I'm Mara Liasson.
The White House says President Clinton has appointed two presidential emergency boards to try to end the Long Island Railroad strike. Mr. Clinton says the labor dispute is regrettable and he wants to bring both sides together. The rail union walked out overnight in a dispute over wages. A federal judge has imposed maximum sentences on five Branch Davidians for their convictions in the deaths of four federal agents last year outside of Waco. The five received 40 years in prison each. One was sentenced to 20 years, another got 15, a third defendant received 5 years. President Clinton has kicked off the World Cup soccer tournament. More than 60,000 people were on hand for the opening ceremonies at the first game. The tournament is being played in the U.S. for the first time at halftime in Chicago. Germany and Bolivia are tied each at zero. This is NPR. France and Italy have told the Western European Union's defense group that they are both ready to send troops to Rwanda to stop the slaughter there. But WEU diplomats say both countries didn't receive any support from other allies. France says 2,000 troops are prepared to leave at once. Italy says it also has a large number of soldiers ready to go, but it didn't offer a figure. Civil war has raged in Rwanda since early April. The death toll is uncertain, but estimates say at least 200,000 people have died. A chemical explosion in Gainesville, Florida, has injured at least 65 people and left many people huddled inside their homes. Kevin Allen of member station WUFT has this report.
The explosion at the chemical plant northwest of Gainesville released a chemical cloud that sent dozens of people to area hospitals, mostly for eye irritations and respiratory problems. Businesses and residents within a 4-square-mile area around the plant were evacuated, and nearby Gainesville Regional Airport closed. Several thousand other residents were told to stay indoors while the chemical cloud passed across the north of the city. About 150 people were taken to a decontamination center to be treated for exposure to the cloud. No cause for the explosion has been officially determined, but plant workers say the blast involved a tanker that was refueling at the plant. For National Public Radio, I'm Kevin Allen in Gainesville.
Defense Secretary William Perry will decide in a few weeks whether to expand the role of women in combat. The Army's number two general is opposed to it. General Binford Pee has told the Senate Armed Services Committee that women should be barred from special operations helicopters and artillery batteries. Army Secretary Togo West wants to open these assignments to women soldiers. He says they would not be in direct face-to-face combat, or rather contact with the enemy. Defense Chief Perry has promised Congress he'll tell them about any changes in the status rule by July 1st. On Wall Street, the Dow is down 35 points at 3,776. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Composer Henry Mancini died on Tuesday at the age of 70. He had pancreatic cancer. On this archive edition of our show, we remember Mancini with a 1987 interview. Henry Mancini composed hundreds of themes for movies and TV. His best-known movie themes became hit songs, like The Days of Wine and Roses and Moon River, the theme from Breakfast at Tiffany's. Mancini was one of the early composers to write jazz themes, like his theme for the TV detective series Peter Gunn and the movie detective spoof The Pink Panther. His many other movie scores include Touch of Evil, A Shot in the Dark, The Glenn Miller Story, and the 1987 remake of The Glass Menagerie. I'd like to go back to the beginning of your career in Hollywood. You started off in the early 1950s at Universal, and I guess you were on contract there, and from the way I understand it, you did about 100 films. One of those films was Touch of Evil, which is directed by Orson mm-hmm. Welles, one of the real great films. Did you do a lot of schlock also?
Well, it was mostly schlock.
Was it?
It was mostly, we had everything there. Let me put it this way. I was there 6 years, and Universal, during that time, made around 50 pictures a year. So that number of 100 is quite under what the real figure would be. But we had all kinds of stuff. Westerns, these old Rory Calhoun Westerns. Ma and Pa Kettle, Francis the Mule, Bonzo the Ape, stuff like that. In addition, well, I got about two or three good pictures while I was there. The Glenn Miller Story was another one.
Did you have to learn all the Hollywood cliches of the period?
Yeah, that was the best part. What do you mean of the period? They're still around. there's no period. I did. I've said that in the past. Learning the cliches was most fun of all, just to know that you could do what the big boys were doing at the time. But that's true. And in doing that, you get that all out of your system. You have attacks of it once in a while sometimes.
Can you describe some of the cliches that you had to learn? Like, was there a certain kind of sound to go for to bring tears to people's eyes and something else that you'd have to use for a Rory Calhoun Western?
Yeah, well, it was the day of the overstated villain, and my boss during those years was Joe Gershenson, who was a marvelous man and very astute dramatically, he was a street guy from New York. And he had a very succinct way. He called it, you know, when you have, like the villain appears, he'd say, I want a jig-a-jig there. And a jig-a-jig was, ba-ba-ba-ba, something like that, you know. And then, of course, the outdoor themes, and it was fun. I really got a kick out of it.
Can you use those cliches now?
If called for, yeah, it depends. You have to be very careful, though, you know, people have to know you have your tongue in your cheek, or else they say, what's that old fogey doing up there, you know?
Now, the theme that you wrote that really made you famous to everybody in America was the theme from Peter Gunn, which was the TV detective show that started in, I think it was 1958. And
right.
he was, I guess, one of the first really cool private eyes on television. Could I ask you to describe what was in your mind when you wrote the score, the sound that you were going for?
Well, first of all, you have to separate the theme from the score. If you notice, the theme has really nothing to do with jazz. The theme I wrote because I said, now, Peter Gunn, what am I going to do here? I have to have something that's going to get their attention right away. And this ostinato bass came in, you know, and it sounded very powerful in the low, with the guitar and the bass and the piano playing, boom, 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 boom. And that was another thing. That was, I think, the secret of the success of that piece was the fact that it was 8 to the bar, which indicated rock and roll. And as you know, there have been many records. Jimi Hendrix recorded it. All along the way, there have been many, many recordings by the rock people. It's a punk favorite, too.
I know. Well, yeah. I'm going to play your recording of it from one album that you made of the theme. And this is Henry Mancini's theme from Peter Gunn. That really does still sound great.
Thank you.
Do you ever
thank
still
you.
Listen to it?
No, not much. I don't. I listen to my things right after I make them. Albums, or if it's a movie, I'll look at it. And whatever I do, I just do them, and then I file them away. And I rarely, unless I come across it, of course, in. On the radio, or I'm looking at TV, and I happen to pass a station, pass a channel that is playing a picture.
No, a friend of mine who used to watch Peter Gunn all the time, still does on reruns, says that he grew up always wanting to be followed around by a walking bass line like Peter Gunn was.
Yeah, well, you know something, a walking bass in television anyhow, or in scoring, has become... is a cliche of that period, you know. But at that time, it hadn't been used that much, and it's the greatest thing for sustaining any kind of a line or an emotion. You do it slow, it has another effect. You do it fast, and you get very exciting music from it. I think that was the key, that opening bass line, yeah, now that I think about it.
We're featuring a 1987 interview with composer Henry Mancini. He died of cancer on Tuesday. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. Back to our interview with Henry Mancini. When you wrote the Pink Panther theme, did you intend that as almost a parody of the Peter Gunn theme?
No. It had nothing to do. It was a different kind of... in fact, the Pink Panther was much more jazz than Peter Gunn. I had no idea when I wrote that theme, which I wrote very quickly, by the way. It just came out. It was like a rush. But I had... written that for David Niven, who played the Phantom. And when Blake told me he was going to have a cartoon, animated feature, not feature, animated cartoon at the beginning, I said, well, gee, I said to myself, well, I've already written that. So I just adapted it and made it fit in with all of the things that they did on the screen.
I just want to play a little taste of the theme that you wrote for the Pink Panther. That you're one of the composers who really helped forge that link between crime stories and jazz themes. And then there was a period, I think, where jazz was used much less, on television especially, for crime themes and for detective themes.
Yeah. Well, in movies, you know, jazz had been used mostly, strangely enough, it's sadly enough, pictures that had sleazy backgrounds or had dope or, you know, had drinking or something of that sort. It was always attached to that. It had that stigma to it. And I was happy at Peter Gunn that I was able to inject some humor, which, of course, you know, jazz can be very humorous if used in the right way.
I want to ask you about another song that you wrote that's become a standard. And I'm thinking of Moon River, which was the theme from Breakfast at Tiffany's. You've written more scores than you have songs, I think. That's fair to say. You're going to correct
yes.
that?
Yes. No.
Oh, okay.
No.
So tell me what you were thinking about when you wrote that song.
Well, you hit a good point there. All of the songs... Just practically all of the songs that I have had written or were popular and are popular now came out of dramatic situations from the movie. In other words, I didn't sit down to write Moon River as a popular song. In fact, I don't think I could do that. I wouldn't know where to start. I have to have something to react to, and therefore all of the songs are actually themes that came out of the various films.
What are some of the strangest places you've heard your songs or themes played?
Oh, goodness. I was in Osaka once, and we were doing concerts. And we went to have something to eat after the concert, and we went up to this place that was like the Top of the Mark or something like that. And they had a piano player came in. And he didn't know we were there at all. He didn't know I was there. And I could see him right now. He's a little, kind of little guy. Had a pinstripe suit. He looked like a hitman for the mafia. And he came in, and he sat down, and the first thing he started playing was Moon River. And he had, it's a simple song, you know. You can play it all on the white keys, and you get off in great shape. But he proceeded to put some exotic harmonies in there. No, exotic's not the right word. Wrong harmonies. And by the time he was finished, we were literally couldn't contain ourselves. My bass player, Abe Laboriel, was over there, and he had slid off the chair under the table because these are musical jokes, you know. And to hear something that, Like, we just finished playing with the orchestra on the stage, and then to hear this guy come and do a version that was really unorthodox. things like that. The funny things are great, you know.
Do you hear your music performed in restaurants and elevators and things like that?
Oh, I hope so. I think, you know, that's a good place to be. That shows that the songs are well known and that people will accept them.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your work.
Well, it's a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Henry Mancini, recorded in 1987. He died Tuesday at the age of 70. His theme from the film The Days of Wine and Roses became a pop and jazz standard. This is the Tony Bennett, Bill Evans version. The lyric is by Johnny Mercer.
Like a child at play through the meadowland toward a closing door, a door marked nevermore that wasn't there before. The lonely night discloses just a passing breeze filled with memories of the golden smile that introduced me to the days of wine and roses and you.
Tony Bennett and Bill Evans' recording of Henry Mancini's The Days of Wine and Roses. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review of two new reissues which may appear to have little in common, except that both were recorded in New York in the mid-1960s. One is an underground classic by Maverick Steve Lacy and Roswell Rudd. The other is a straight-ahead date by pianist Duke Pearson. Kevin says these records are stylistically very different, but some similarities creep in anyway. This is Duke Pearson's tune, Los Malos Hombres, The Bad Men.
Jazz is in a divided state these days, as usual. But in any period, even feuding musicians share common values. In our time, such diverse composers as Muhal Richard Abrams, Wynton Marsalis, and John Zorn all write postmodern music, which juxtaposes various identifiable jazz and non-jazz styles. Every decade offers similar examples. Two very different new reissues from the divided 1960s both radiate the same good feel and have some of the same rhythmic inflections. One is the live School Days by saxophonist Steve Lacy and trombonist Roswell Rudd. Their quartet played piano music without a piano. They did only Thelonious Monk tunes. One night when the bass player was late, they performed Baya with just horns and drums. Listen to drummer Dennis Charles, who was born in the West Indies and was playing both free jazz and calypso gigs in 1963. Roswell Rudd group was classic because so many styles ran together. Dixieland, avant-garde, modern jazz, and old blues become inseparable. Pianist Duke Pearson's album, The Right Touch, is easier to pigeonhole. It's a pretty typical 1967 Blue Note record. The arrangements are more conventional, but the loose way the parts fit together can be remarkably similar. A subtle Caribbean feel surfaces occasionally, although drummer Grady Tate comes from North Carolina. The trumpet player is Freddie Hubbard. In the 1960s, jazz's Latin feel, the so-called Spanish tinge, was fed by musicians from all over, not all of whom spoke Spanish. They included bossa nova Brazilians, West Indians like Dennis Charles, and pianist Horace Silver, whose people came from the Portuguese Cape Verde Islands off West Africa. All these strains mingled in New York, where working musicians play all sorts of gigs and absorb and regurgitate all sorts of influences. Steve Lacy and Duke Pearson may have traveled in different circles, but they walked the same sidewalks and heard the same drum beats in current records. So it's no big surprise both their groups reflect their place and time. In a self-expressive music like jazz, it's hard not to do that.
Kevin Whitehead writes for CD Review, Coda, Pulse, and The Village Voice. He reviewed the new reissues The Right Touch, featuring Duke Pearson, and School Days, featuring Steve Lacy and Roswell Rudd. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Dennis Hopper is currently starring in two movies, Speed and Red Rock West. Coming up from the archives, an interview with Hopper about his roles in Rebel Without a Cause, Easy Rider, and Blue Velvet. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Wolf, starring Jack Nicholson as a book editor transformed during a full moon. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The Los Angeles District Attorney has filed murder charges against O.J. Simpson in the deaths of his ex-wife and a friend of hers. Arraignment is set for this afternoon. A spokesman for the DA's office says no bail will be allowed. The Associated Press is quoting a source who says authorities have focused their investigation only on Simpson. There's confusion over whether the United States will or won't try to impose sanctions against North Korea. Former President Jimmy Carter reportedly told North Korean President Kim Il-sung that the U.S. would stop seeking the embargo, but the White House has disavowed that statement. Assistant Secretary of State Robert Gallucci told NPR earlier today the discussion of sanctions is still going on at the U.N.
The President said yesterday that we would be attempting to follow up on the message we got from Jimmy Carter through diplomatic channels. To see whether it means what it may mean and provide the basis for us to resume our talks with the North Koreans. But until then, though, we are going to continue consultations in New York on a sanctions resolution.
North Korean President Kim told Mr. Carter yesterday that two U.N. nuclear inspectors will be allowed to stay in the country. Mr. Carter had said the two were scheduled to be expelled. The Supreme Court ruled today that when a defendant's future dangerousness is an issue in a death sentencing proceeding, and the alternative to the death penalty is life without parole, the jury must be told that the defendant is not eligible for parole. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
Jonathan Dale Simmons had already been convicted of assaulting two elderly women when he beat a third old woman to death. He was convicted of murder, and because of his two prior convictions, he was ineligible for parole ever again. So when his trial reached the sentencing phase, he argued that he was only a danger to elderly women and would not be a danger to them behind bars. The prosecutor, however, argued that Simmons, if allowed to live, would be a danger to society. And when the jury asked whether Simmons would ever be eligible for parole, the judge informed them that they were not to consider parole in their deliberations. The jury sentenced Simmons to death. Today, the Supreme Court set aside the death sentence by a 7-2 vote. The court ruled that when a defendant's future dangerousness is an issue and state law prohibits his release on parole, the sentencing jury must be informed of that fact if the defendant wishes. I'm Nina Totenberg at the Supreme Court.
President Clinton went to a Chicago housing project today to call for the passage of his crime bill. He calls it the most important measure ever to face Congress, and he's demanding its immediate passage. Mr. Clinton made his appeal at the Robert Taylor Homes in Chicago, the nation's largest housing project. On Wall Street, stocks closed lower today. The Dow Jones Industrials lost almost 35 points to end the day at 3,776. Declining issues led advances in heavy trading. This is NPR. The Clinton administration wants to provide more than 600,000 jobs for the nation's youth this summer. The government is asking the private sector to hire another 300,000 young people. NPR's Greg Peppers reports.
The jobs program would cost $908 million and be targeted for poor youth from age 14 to 21 who live in communities with high rates of joblessness. Labor officials are calling on the private sector to increase the number of young people it hires this summer. The administration wants private employers to create jobs for 330,000 youths. A series of public service announcements include Labor Secretary Robert Reich and others calling on entrepreneurs to give the nation's youth a chance. The employers will get no federal incentives to hire young workers except the targeted jobs tax credit, under which the government pays part of the wages of disadvantaged workers. The White House says the tax credit is ineffective and has recommended scrapping it. In addition to a job for the summer, program participants will also receive instruction in math and reading. They will earn at least a minimum wage and work an average of 30 hours per week. Local program operators will determine the kind of jobs in which the workers will be placed. I'm Greg Peppers in Washington.
Congress is on the verge of giving American airports new money. The Senate has approved its version of a $6 billion plan to finance construction of new airport facilities. The new projects would range from runways to sewers, and there would also be money for improved security. The Senate bill is being reconciled with a House bill in a conference committee. Vice President Al Gore is predicting that the final health care reform package that Congress agrees upon will be close to what President Clinton wants. Gore told CBS today that he's confident that health care reform will get through Congress this year. Gore also says universal coverage will be a part of this. House Speaker Thomas Foley says he's confident that health care reform will come up for a vote next month on the House floor. I'm Korva Coleman, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
All right. We're giving our neighbor a joyride. Let's get on with it. Anyone want to go on a joyride with us? How about you?
Dennis Hopper made his comeback in the 1986 film Blue Velvet, confirming that he was brilliant at acting crazy. You can see him now in two crazy killer roles, in the independent film Red Rock West and the big summer thriller Speed. Here he is in Speed as the mad bomber.
What do you think, Jack? You think if you pick up all the bus driver's teeth, they'll give you another medal? You think I wouldn't have been prepared? 2 years I spent setting up that elevator job. 2 years I invested myself in it. You couldn't understand the kind of commitment that I have. You were in a man's life's work, and you think you can walk away. You got blinders on to the world. But I got your attention now, didn't I, Jack?
Why didn't you just come after me?
No, this is about me. This is about my money. This is about money due me, which I will collect. $3.7 million. It's my nest egg, Jack. At my age, you've got to think ahead.
On this archive edition of Fresh Air, we're featuring a 1990 interview with Dennis Hopper. Just a few years before Hopper's comeback, he was institutionalized, paranoid, and totally disoriented from years of drugs and booze. Hopper started acting in movies when he was a teenager and had a small part in Rebel Without a Cause. In 1969, he became famous for directing and co-starring in the counterculture road movie Easy Rider. Now he's reestablished himself as a director as well as an actor. He directed Colors and The Hotspot. We talked first about Hopper's role as Frank Booth in David Lynch's Blue Velvet. Frank Booth is a crazy, dangerous character, but when Hopper read the script, he said to Lynch, "I am Frank."
I didn't have a problem with Frank. I just understood him. And I called David. I'd never met David, and he'd given me the part, and I called him. He was down in North Carolina already. They'd begun filming. And I said, "You don't have to worry about this. I am Frank. I really understand this role." So he got off the phone. He told Isabella and Kyle MacLachlan and Laura that, he said, "My God, I just got off the phone with Dennis Hopper." And he said he was Frank. He said, "That may be great for the movie, but how are we going to have lunch with him?" But I really meant that I understood the role. And I do understand Frank. You know, I've known Frank. I've known a lot of guys like Frank.
Did you think that you were like Frank at some point in your life?
Well, I understood his sexual obsession, you know. And I, even though David wrote it as the stuff that he was sniffing as helium, I had always thought of it as some sort of drug, you know, like an amyl nitrate or a nitric oxide. And I asked David if it would be all right to play it that way. He had helium on the set, and helium, all helium does, it doesn't disorient your mind. All it does is make you sound like Daffy Duck. So I tried it, and I said, "David, I'm really aware. I'm just hearing my voice. I'm not, you know, able to act." I said, "I want something. Couldn't I try to use something that, like, disoriented my mind?" And he said, "What?" And I said, "Well, think, watch this, I'd do a sense memory of an amyl nitrate, nitric oxide or something." He said, "What are those things?" I said, "Just watch." So anyway, he liked what he saw. And I said, "If you want to dub that voice in the helium voice in later, we could do that." And he said, "No, I don't think it'll be necessary." Anyway, we didn't dub it in later, and it did work. But, you know, since then, I started thinking how strange it would be If I'd used that helium voice and not had it disorient my mind, what a strange character he had actually written, even more stranger than my portrayal of Frank.
Yeah, I see what you mean.
You know, it'd just been this guy who takes this, that does this mask and gets this weird voice and then does all those things and nothing else happens to him. It would be very bizarre. But anyway, because when I read it, I thought of it that way, of the drug kind of drug-crazed guy and the sexual kind of strange appetite that he had. I could identify with those things.
Do you like roles with the kind of intensity that your performance has in the character of Frank?
Well, like, you know, I think that probably of all the work that I've done, Frank is probably the flashiest role I ever had.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I like it on that level. You know.
You grew up on a farm. Were you anxious to get away when you were growing up?
Yeah, I wanted to know where the trains were going. I had a wonderful childhood, though. My mother ran a swimming pool in Dodge City, Kansas, and I lived with my grandparents. My father was at war in the Second World War, and I lived with my grandparents on a small farm, and then my grandfather worked on a larger farm in Garden City, Kansas, and a wheat farm that I would go out and work on during the summer, and I had a wonderful childhood on that level.
Your mother was very religious. She was a fundamentalist?
I don't know where that sort of started. My mother is religious, yeah. Yeah.
What was your attitude about God?
When I was younger, she wasn't as religious as she became later in my life. I wasn't raised under any great pressure as her being a fundamentalist when I was a young kid. So that's sort of gotten distorted.
So there wasn't... there weren't...
Religious pressures?
Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, I could wear lipstick and I could dress as a girl anytime I wanted to. Is that what you mean? Things like that? Yeah, and I was allowed to dance on the table and so on. No, I
took the words out of my mouth.
Thanks, yeah. All right. Wait till I put this lipstick on, will you? No.
Yeah.
No, I didn't have those kind of pressures. I went to Sunday school and things like that, but I didn't have a lot of pressures in those ways. When I first saw my first movies when I was a kid, they really affected me, and I wanted to know how they were made. And I'm not sure that that's uncommon for any kid who first sees his films or first sees television or whatever.
We're featuring a 1990 interview with Dennis Hopper. We'll be back with more after this break. This is Fresh Air. With Dennis Hopper.
Your first movie role was in Rebel Without a Cause. You were, I think, 18 years old. Did the movie help give you a sense of teenagers being their own culture and their own misunderstood culture? Were you already feeling that way?
When I went on that picture, I saw James Dean for the first time act. And at that point, all I was concerned about was being an actor. I wasn't concerned about, like, you know, whether people were juvenile delinquents or not. I had sort of come out of that, out of San Diego and Tijuana and that kind of area. But I was interested in acting, and I saw James Dean act, and I basically, through Rebel Without a Cause, I was just trying to figure out what he was doing because I thought I was the best young actor at that time in the world, and I suddenly ran into this guy who was some years older than me, but he was doing work that I was so far over my head, I actually grabbed him on the Chicky Run and threw him into a car and said, "What are you doing? You got to teach me what you're doing."
So what did he teach you?
He wanted to know what my motivation was for wanting to act. Yeah, you know? And he asked me if I'd... had a problem with my parents, that if I had actually hated my parents, and that was part of the drive that I had to want to become an actor. And I said that actually I had felt that. And he said, well, that's what he felt also, and that his mother died when he was very young, and he used to go to her grave and cry on her grave and say, Mother, why have you left me? Why have you left me? And that turned into, I'm going to show you, I'm going to show you, I'm going to be someone. And that was the drive that he had brought into his acting, which I described the same sort of feelings that I was misunderstood by my parents, and that I had that feeling when they came to the theater that I was going to show them. And it was like, you know, I'm going to show you, I'm going to be something, I'm going to be an actor. So this drive, this confused kind of drive and wanting to put it into other people's other parts and other things, and these feelings, to use them in some sort of imaginary given circumstance, became the key for acting. But anyway, he said, you must learn how to not worry about the emotions, but you must learn how to do things and not show them. You must learn how to smoke a cigarette and just not act smoking the cigarette. You must learn how to drink a drink, not act drinking the drink. And if somebody knocks on the door, you go and answer the door. Then you see they have a gun in their hand. Then you react to the gun and so on. So basically, it's like don't indicate, but like do something and don't show it. And moment-to-moment reality. Never anticipate what the next moment's going to hold. And so, like, you know, he said, then, you know, you're a very good technical actor, so get rid of all that technique, though. Stop the line readings. Don't worry about how it's going to come out. Just let it come out. Work on a moment-to-moment reality level.
Stop the line readings. What did you stop doing?
Well, I mean, like, you know, I was out of a classical theater background, so, I mean, there were ways of reading lines, you know. I mean, even hello, how are you became a way of reading a line. So there's a lot of ways to say hello, how are you, besides one fixed way that you decide in your room somewhere that that's the way you're going to say hello, how are you.
Was James Dean the first friend that you had who died? I mean, like someone of around your age.
Yeah, I mean, there had been, I would think, yeah.
Did it scare you a lot to have someone who
was
close to you?
Well, it was more, I mean, more than a friend. I think of him more as a teacher than as a friend. We did two films together, which took about a year of our lives. He only made three movies. We did Rebel Without a Cause and then Giant. And then he died 2 weeks before we finished shooting Giant. So I was like 19, he was 24. It was more, we dealt with acting. We talked about acting. It wasn't like we went out and drank beers together and got high or like race cars or anything. When he died, it just destroyed me because I totally had this belief in destiny and how people are destined, you know, to be, to fulfill their destiny, you know, and I just couldn't understand why James Dean had died so young. He wanted to direct movies. He had only been in three movies, and it just destroyed my whole concept of destiny, life, and that kind of thing for years. I mean, probably still, till this day, it still bothers me. I miss him. I wish I'd have seen his work.
Dennis Hopper is my guest. There's a kind of, I think, pretty famous story about what happened, an incident that happened in your early career. And you were working on a movie that Henry Hathaway was directing, and he was trying to get you to do the scene the way he wanted to. You had your own way of wanting to do it. And I think this went on for like 12 hours or something of you doing takes and him insisting that you do it his way.
Mm-hmm.
And then he finally won.
Mm-hmm.
And I think because of your rebelliousness that you were pretty much exiled from Hollywood for a while. Is that
yeah,
right?
For a long time. Till he rehired me again.
Till he rehired you again.
Yeah, 7 or 8 years later.
So did you end up doing a lot of TV in that period?
Yeah.
I recently saw you on The Rifleman. I think it was the first episode.
Right. You know, Sam Peckinpah wrote the pilot of The Rifleman, which I did.
Oh, so it was the pilot star. I saw,
yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm wondering, you know, now that you're directing again, if you ever see yourself in the Henry Hathaway role of really wanting the actor to do it your way.
I don't see myself any other way.
You mean you see...
Did I hear a pause?
Yes.
Did you hear a pin drop? I'm the director, so I want them to do it my way.
So if you saw the young Dennis Hopper coming in and he insisted on doing it his way, what would have happened?
I would have probably been amazed by the young Dennis Hopper and let him do it his way. But I would have never let him know that he was doing it. I mean, I would have given him plenty of space to do it his way. Hathaway didn't. But if it comes down to doing it my way, I mean, it's got to be my way. But like I give actors a lot of room to work. I mean, I never had a problem with Sean Penn. I never had a problem with Robert Duvall. I had problems with Don Johnson, but I don't have problems seeing what I got on the screen with Don Johnson because we worked it out and he did it my way.
What kind of problems did you have with
him? Well, I just found him not a steady actor, you know, at times, you know, and like that we had to work really hard to get him to like be real, to do things real and so on. And we did work hard and Don worked very hard on this, and it's a great performance by Don. He's never been better than he is in the hot spot. The director is the boss, and that's just the way it is. So Hathaway, I learned that from Hathaway. Also, I learned a lot of things from Hathaway. I did 3 films for Hathaway. He was the boss, and the director is the boss. And if you're in a director's movie and you don't do what the director wants you to do, you might as well, it doesn't matter how good you are, you look like you're out of step with everybody else, and you might as well just hang it up right there because it's no sense fighting him.
I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Okay.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Dennis Hopper, recorded in 1990. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what are you covering?
Well, we're covering the charges against O.J. Simpson and the murder of his ex-wife and her friend Ronald Goldman. We'll be hearing about that from California today. Also, a story sorting out the apparently conflicting comments from Washington and from former President Carter, who's in North Korea, about what the U.S. position on proposed sanctions against North Korea is. Noah Adams has a special story on prayer and what prayer means in the lives of several people. And we'll also be hearing about the first game in the World Cup.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The team of Nichols and Nicholson, director Mike Nichols and actor Jack Nicholson, have made 4 films together: Carnal Knowledge, which was a major success, The Fortune and Heartburn, which weren't, and now, of all things, a werewolf picture. Film critic Stephen Schiff has this review of Wolf.
Of all the varieties of horror movies, the ones about transformation have always had the strongest hold on our imaginations. Transformation. If the vampire bites you, you become hungry for blood. If the werewolf bites you, you sprout hair and howl at the full moon. If you sleep in the vicinity of a pod, you become a body snatcher yourself. What makes transformation movies so eerie and powerful is their central ambiguity. Would it really be so bad, we ask ourselves, if we were transformed? Sure, being a vampire has its drawbacks, but maybe immortality and demonic power are their own rewards. As for the myth of the werewolf, well, that has always been about sexual transformation. You grow hair in strange places and have odd desires at night. What is that but a metaphor for puberty? One of the best things about the movie Wolf is the way Mike Nichols and his screenwriters, Jim Harrison and Wesley Strick, have made being a werewolf rather attractive. Jack Nicholson plays Will Randall, an aging New York book editor who's the last of a dying breed. He's honorable, literary, and not a cutthroat. Not, in other words, a corporate wolf. That's unfortunate for him because his publishing house has just been taken over by a ruthless tycoon who has decided to replace him with his smarmy and completely unscrupulous underling, who's played by James Spader with plenty of oil and sleaze. Then, one wintry night in Vermont, Will is driving along the back roads when he hits an animal. The creature seems dead until Will tries to lift him and gets a nasty bite for his trouble. A few days later, he's sitting in his doctor's office with a thermometer in his mouth, trying to explain what happened.
A wolf bit me.
I don't think so, Will.
You weren't there, Will.
You sure it wasn't a husky or a German shepherd? I mean, after all, it was night, wasn't it? It was dark out.
Full moon. And to answer your question, it was a wolf. I was staring straight at it. You don't confuse a dog with a wolf.
I see. Whatever you say. You know, it's funny. This isn't the first rabies shot I've given in the last few months. My wife's sister-in-law up in Oneonta, a raccoon chased her up on her porch and bit her in the ass. Last summer, the son of a friend of mine sustained brain damage from a snake bite. This kid was just sitting in front of his pool, and the next thing you know, he has brain damage.
Is he all right?
Who?
Your friend's son.
No, you idiot. He has brain damage.
Pretty soon, Will is feeling strangely younger and more virile. He hears and sees better, and he even starts plotting a ferocious corporate counterattack to get his old job back. I had thought Nicholson might be laughable in a role like this. But instead of heading straight over the top the way he did in The Shining and Batman, he turns Will into a figure of enormous subtlety and grace. Wolfhood makes Will suaver, cannier, more attractive, and Nicholson's magnetic performance is matched by the one Michelle Pfeiffer gives as the spoiled rich girl who falls for Will. Pfeiffer makes you sense the hurt and yearning beneath her forbiddingly brittle veneer. In fact, the romantic banter between Nicholson and Pfeiffer and the tart talk in the halls of publishing are so entertaining that you almost wish the movie would give up its hokey Wolfman premise and, well, transform itself into what it clearly wants to be, a romantic drama about the death of New York's literary world. But no, this is a horror movie, and the more it insists on the spectacle of lengthening fangs and bristling hair, the clumsier it looks. As a werewolf picture, Wolf is a bit of a flop, but that's what makes it so much fun.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman and Chris Fraley. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our interns are Philo Holland, Mark Tullis, and Abby Beshkin. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with the madman of salsa, pianist Eddie Palmieri. He's been a leading musician on the Latin music scene for over 25 years. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.